Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. 130 years ago, a scientist at Oxford University decided he was going to measure the power of prayer. Francis Galton looked at the lifespan of doctors and priests and lawyers over a 100-year period. He discovered that lawyers and doctors lived longer than priests. He reasoned that churchgoers pray for their priests, so he concluded that prayer doesn't work. Well, tell that to the 1.5 million Americans who have already signed up for what's referred to as the Presidential Prayer Team.
America is a great nation.
We pray that God will bless America, the land that we all love.
So what can you and I do to help keep America great? According to our president, we can pray. That's why we urge you to join the Presidential Prayer Team. Our goal is to enlist 2.8 million Americans to pray daily for the president, his cabinet, and other national leaders. There is no cost or obligation. When you join, you'll receive a beautiful decal to proudly display your service to our country. More importantly, we'll keep you up to date on the prayer needs of the president.
Oh, and still today, the power of prayer continues to be studied. Much of the current research is at the medical schools across the country, concentrating not on prayer and politics, but prayer and medicine. Prayer for people who are sick. It's not so much focused on the bedside ritual of family and friends. This is research that looks at how the prayers of strangers can affect health. This hour, we talk with a couple of experts who study and write about the power of prayer. Now, Connection listeners, can the power of prayer be measured? Should it? And if science was able to prove that prayer works, would it change how or whether you pray? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us today is Larry Dossey. He's a physician and a writer who studied the power of prayer for close to 20 years. He's the author of Healing Words, The Power of Prayer and the Practice of Medicine, among other books. He's joining us from a studio in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And also with us today, Stephen Post, a professor at the Center for Biomedical Ethics. He's at the School of Medicine at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. Stephen's been studying the connection between spirituality and health for many years. He's at the studios of the public radio station WCPN in Cleveland. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon. It's good to be with you.
It's good to be with you. Thanks.
Larry, let me start with you. Your favorite recent study of how we understand or how people are looking at the power of prayer. Which is the one that you would like to refer to?
I like to refer to the study which was published in the medical journal a couple of years ago out of Columbia University, in which the researchers at Columbia recruited people from North America and Australia to pray for women in a fertility clinic in Seoul, Korea, who were trying to become pregnant by using in vitro fertilization and embryo transfer techniques. Now, this in the business is what we call a triple blind study, which means that the women themselves, as well as the physicians who were taking care of them, had not a clue that this study was even going on. So everybody was kept in the dark. And the results, long story short, reveal that the women who received intercessory prayer from the other side of the world had twice the successful pregnancy rate as women who were just treated conventionally.
Now, intercessory prayer, we need a definition here. That's prayer, what kind of prayer?
Intercessory comes from Latin words meaning to go between. Presumably the person doing the praying is acting as a facilitator or go between between the individual being prayed for and usually what is conceived as a higher power, however that higher power is named.
But in this case, what's important is that the people doing the praying were complete strangers. They weren't friends or family of these women who were trying to get pregnant.
That's correct. They didn't know who they were praying for. This is about as antiseptic and sanitized a version of prayer as you can get, and I think a lot of people would say that if prayer can work in that very limited way, it might be even more effective in real life.
Stephen Post, what about this idea of measuring the power of prayer by measuring prayer by complete strangers for people who don't know they're being prayed for?
I think one of the issues really is what we mean by prayer. Intercessory prayer is a uniquely Western concept that assumes a deity. It is theistic. One is petitioning a power in the universe that is higher than our own with a request that may or may not, in fact, be good, reasonable, and decent. On the other hand, in the Eastern context, and we see much of this in the literature these days, people study compassionate intentions. They study.
I don't know what you mean by a compassionate intention.
Well, they look at phenomenon such as visualization or concentrated loving intentions, which are directed in imagery at other individuals who may be ill.
But this is very personal. But the point isn't is, this isn't something that a stranger can project.
Oh yes, it is. I mean, the studies do in fact proceed on the basis of non-kin, and strangers are recruited to engage in these practices. But my point is that this is not petitionary prayer in the sense of what we would call in the Western sense intercessory prayer, because it does not assume that there is a mediating entity, God, who has purposes of his or her own.
And Larry, if we take that distinction that Stephen's talking about, that's in one part where the whole idea of studying prayer rubs theologians the wrong way, right?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I followed this debate for a couple of decades, and I've really scratched my head to try to figure out why some theologians really get their backs up about these studies. And I think Stephen is right about this. I think some theologians, Western theologians, see that many of these studies tend to what they consider trivialize prayer or denature it. Some researchers actually describe what is going on here as intercessory prayer and the intervention of a deity. Other researchers simply prefer to talk about distant intentionality. Some talk about the distant effects of compassion and love. And I think this really stretches some theologians past the breaking point. So at a point, they will say, look, we're not talking about prayer anymore. You know, this is too flaky. We can't get our minds around this. This is too New Agey and so on. So they just simply prefer to go in the other direction and want to have nothing to do with these studies.
Sorry, Larry. One of the criticisms that I've heard is, though, that when you try to measure prayer in the way that science has tried to measure prayer, you're quantifying it. You are, and then you're trivializing it. You're saying this is like medicine. This is a prescription. This is something that I want.
Well, I would be the first to acknowledge that we cannot measure prayer. Researchers don't have any prayer meters. All they can do is to look at correlations in actual patients that occur when certain people pray. I think I know most of the researchers in this country who are actually doing these studies, and I don't know any of them who are trying to test God or squeeze the Almighty or put God in a test tube. Most of them actually go at these studies with an extraordinarily reverential point of view. They don't know how this works. They just simply are trying to take an empirical approach to what happens in patients when other people take various attitudes toward them, including prayer.
Stephen, what do you make of the theologians' arguments here?
Well, there are some theologians of significance, like Stanley Hauerwas at Duke, who Time magazine rated as the most influential Protestant of our time, who view these scientific efforts as reductive because they really make spirituality and religion very utilitarian. These kinds of practices, such as prayer, are good, and so long as they are useful, so long as they are responded to, and so forth. But in fact, the theologians will sometimes say God is entirely mysterious, that God's purposes are certainly not assumed to be congruent with our own. I have an 8-year-old son who petitions me every day for all sorts of things, from additional Pokemon cards to whatever it might be. And if I indulged him in every request, I would be locked up in a psychiatric institution. So there is a sense in which the rabbinic tradition, for example, has always said that there is a hubris in measuring the effects of prayer. And if you look at the Hebrew Bible, there are some interesting accounts where God does answer a prayer, and there are some accounts where God doesn't. And it entirely depends on who's praying, under what circumstances, for what, and with what motivations. So those are the issues for the theologians, that somehow measuring this and thinking that we can leverage efficacy of intercessory prayer, it demeans the mystery and the sublime quality of the will of God.
And Larry, what about criticism from within the medical community that says it's a waste of time, let's work on the drugs, let's not work on stuff like this?
Yeah, well, there is that point of view out there, but it's not quite as vocal as you might imagine. Just as an example, 10 years ago, there were only 3 medical schools in the entire United States out of the 125 total medical schools in our country that had any formal coursework looking at the role of religious devotion and spiritual practices, including prayer, on in terms of their impact on human health. Currently, there are about 80 medical schools out of the 125 that do feature courses that attend to this kind of information. Now, I'm not implying that they're standing up and cheering about this, but at least they put it on the table, and it's become a part of the medical academic dialogue. So I think that's a telling indication that mainstream medicine is becoming more open to some of these avenues.
I mean, part of the problem, I would suppose, Stephen, is where we began a couple of minutes ago by talking about how you define prayer, but whether or not it fits within a whole range of alternate therapy, which is relatively new to Western allopathic medicine.
Well, that's right. I work in a medical school, and there's a lot of interest in spirituality and health, but
right. Most
of it focuses on how patients draw on their spiritual and religious traditions and practices to cope with severe diagnoses. That literature is overwhelming. 93% of women in the gynecological cancer research program at the University of Michigan indicated that their major way of coping was through spirituality. So these facts are absolutely clear, and it's no question in anyone's mind that physicians need to respect the religious beliefs and practices of patients, and that this ultimately is probably good for therapeutic outcomes. As to your other point, people are interested in prayer. They believe that anything can be studied scientifically. I agree with Larry on this. I just don't think at this point that there's any really conclusive study indicating that intercessory prayer is effective.
All right, Connection listeners, is prayer a matter of mystery and faith? Is there anything wrong with trying to measure it scientifically? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With us on the program today, Larry Dossey. He is executive editor of the journal Alternative Therapies in Health and Medicine. Wrote the best-selling book Healing Words, The Power of Prayer and the Practice of Medicine. Stephen Post is also with us. He is a biomedical ethicist at the School of Medicine at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. And we're talking about measuring the power of prayer. There is that study that was done at the Duke University Medical Center when 150 heart patients were gathered together and then divided up into 5 groups of 30. And Larry, if I understand it, what happened then was one group was the control group got no sort of alternate therapy. One was treated with therapeutic touch, one with stress relaxation, one with guided imagery, and one group targeted by off-site prayer, the type of long-distance intercessory prayer that we were talking about. Did I get that sort of right in terms of setting the table there?
Yeah, that's pretty good, Dick. This was a study in patients who reported to Duke's emergency room at their cardiovascular hospital with severe chest pain, and these people underwent urgent cardiac catheterization and angioplasty, where one's coronary arteries are dilated. This is a double-blind, randomized controlled study, and the intervention group receiving the prayer had prayer solicited for them from around the world, from people from various prayer traditions, including Buddhists, Hindus, Jews, and Christians, and so forth. The group receiving the assigned prayer had 50 to 100% fewer side effects from these invasive cardiac procedures than the people who were treated conventionally without assigned prayer.
Now, we don't know necessarily what the religion of the 30 people who were being prayed for was. That doesn't come into it, right?
Presumably not. But this was taking place in Duke, so I think we can assume that most of them were Protestants.
Okay. Stephen, double-blind, randomized, controlled study. I mean, what's to quarrel with here?
Well, Dick, looking at this article carefully, and having had a conversation with one of the authors, Harold Koenig, on Friday about it, he highlighted a number of points. First of all, the authors indicate that there are no statistically significant findings in this study whatsoever. The 30 people who were prayed for by strangers in whatever way that may have occurred, we don't have any details, may have done a little better, but they did not do significantly better, and so the results there are explicable as random. Also, I point out a quote from the article: all mortality occurred in noetic therapy groups.
What does that mean?
Vis-a-vis the fifth arm, in which there was no noetic therapy of any kind.
What's noetic therapy? Sorry, I don't know that word.
There were five arms. There were there was an arm that was utilizing imagery, one that was using healing touch, one that was using relaxation techniques, and the fourth was using the intercessory prayer. All of that comes under the category of noetic interventions as this study describes them.
Okay.
And then the fifth arm is just getting standard allopathic therapy. So the point in the study is that all the mortality occurred at a six-month period in the noetic therapy groups and not in the group, the fifth arm, individuals who were not receiving any of these four forms of noetic intervention. So it's not a very strong study. And the conclusion at the end of it is simply from the authors that this is suggestive and interesting. It is insignificant and give them the idea that they want to do something on a larger scale. Remember, there were only 30 subjects in each arm, so this is a relatively small study that doesn't offer any terribly substantive results in my reading of it.
Larry, let me hear from you.
Yeah, well, the authors differ in their interpretation of these statistics. I also have had the opportunity to talk to the lead author of this study, Dr. Mitchell Krukoff, who is director of cardiovascular laboratories at Duke. And their impression of the statistics was that they were so suggestive that the study has indeed been extended to 10 to 12 other major hospitals across the country. So I think that if one wants to have a broad view of where this research leads, what one must do is to look at all of the studies that have been done to date in this field of intercessory prayer or distant healing and try to come up with a projection of what all of these studies are telling us. There's a way to do this. It's called a systematic or meta-analysis, where you lump all the data together from these studies. Currently, there are 9 major studies in human beings looking at the effects of distant healing or intercessory prayer, and 6 of these 9 studies show statistical significance that something is going on here. You can pick single studies which don't show statistical significance, but in order to get the drift of the field, the main direction, one looks at what we call one of these systematic or meta-analytic studies.
Let's go to our callers now. Casey's on the line in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hi, Casey.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Well, first and foremost, I just wanted to commend any study on anything that will invigorate an interest in prayer. Because, I mean, God commands us to love him not only with our hearts but our minds as well. So I think inquiry is very important. But I think a problem arises when you're applying empirical measurements or success rates to prayer because, well, basically the definition of prayer is it's our discourse between oneself and with God or your deity. And prayer is not about what we can do, you know, to control God's actions or movements. And it's not something that's reflected in one's health or anything like that. It's more of to do with your personal relationship with God.
But Casey, if you had someone in your family who was ill and a dozen of you went into the hospital and prayed at the bedside of that person and that person got better, you would be saying we succeeded or prayer succeeded.
Well, I don't think that necessarily your success is going to have to do with success defined by us may be, you know, improvement in health. For instance, my grandfather right now is suffering from lung cancer, and, you know, I pray for him daily. But God's will may not be for him to be on this earth any longer. So maybe his soul being at peace with the Lord is success. But that's not something that can be measured empirically by his health.
So what you're saying, Casey,
is
that if the power of prayer could in fact be measured, you'd really rather not know about it because it kind of interferes in the relationship that you have with God, right?
Well, not necessarily that I wouldn't want to know about it. It's just, you know, Romans 11 tells us that, you know, the depths and the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. I mean, I don't think that, you know, our mind, our knowledge is a little tiny pinpoint in the whole scheme of things. And I think it's virtually impossible for us to get a grasp on our Creator and everything that he has in his thoughts. But I don't think that it's you know, futile attempts. I think that it is important to examine and to inquire and to ask, but I think it's more of a personal relationship, and it's not something that you can define and put down on paper, and, you know, it's the same for everyone else.
But if scientists could persuade you that you could define it and put it down on paper, would you want to know about it?
Oh, definitely, but I don't think that it can be done.
Yeah, okay. Larry, go ahead.
Yeah, I would just want to make the point that this is utterly mysterious. I agree with the caller to that extent. But quite frankly, it is being put down on paper. I keep coming back to the raw fact that 9 human studies have been done so far. 6 of the 9 show statistically significant evidence that people in general, on average, are better off if they get prayed for than if they don't. I don't know how to make that data go away. People certainly don't have to accept it, but there it is.
You know, the part about it that I don't get, though, Larry, is that to have a control study, you know, if you're dealing with medicine, for example, you give somebody the new medicine, you give someone else a placebo.
Right.
In measuring the power of prayer, if you were to give one group prayer, how do you make sure that the other group's not getting prayer, that there isn't a cousin or an uncle or a friend or a sister or a son or a daughter who's praying for those people, in which case the results are all screwed up, aren't they?
Well, they're not totally screwed up. I have discussed this issue with epidemiologists at the NIH who have been involved with these studies. You know, if a factor applies in both sides, in the treatment and the control group, if your numbers are big enough in the study, in terms of the subjects you're dealing with, presumably that effect would balance off between both sides. Now, it may or may not. That's a hugely murky area. So what do you do, Dick? One of the reasons that people have resorted to looking at the effects of prayer not in people, but, say, in animals and plants and so on, is that you can overcome this very common objection about human prayer studies. And these studies in which people look at the effects of prayer, let's say, on the growth rates of tumors in mice, for example, you can really have a pure control group that does not get prayer and that doesn't pray for itself. So you can elevate the quality and the precision and the elegance of these studies to a very high degree if you also do them not just in people, but in non-human beings.
Stephen, does it complicate it or simplify it if we talk about groups of people praying for plants to grow or tumors to shrink?
Oh, boy. This is so complex. I think that there are studies, pretty good studies, indicating that people who think they're being prayed for may do a little better. I'm not convinced that blind intercessory prayer has any particular effect on individuals. So I think that this may be an area where Larry and I are a little bit different in our interpretation of the current state of the art. When you're talking about praying for the growth of a plant and all of this, you know, we're really into an area of ESP, what sometimes is called non-local mind. I think that's an expression that Larry uses from time to time. It's very interesting. It may be the case, science can study, whether the human brain indeed has powers to project itself in an effective way beyond its own small 3-pound domain. Mm-hmm. That, though, again, is a very different kind of a study than an intercessory prayer study. If one wanted to do a meta-analysis, I'm intrigued by Larry's idea, which is probably a good one. It would be difficult to sort out what sorts of techniques we're considering here in these various studies.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Jerry's joining us now from Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
I have a couple of comments to make and a problem I have with all this. As somebody said earlier, I think the person speaking against this study, I guess that's what he would define it as, about thinking positively in the Eastern sense. And I try to think positively. I also try to act positively, and I think that's the difference. You know, if you're thinking positively, if you're thinking the prayer works, it may help, you know. It may help you physically. The second point is the other fellow said he liked the idea of putting prayer on the table by scientists. Now, this is the same thing that was done with evolutionary theory. And look what it's come to in Kansas and places like that. I don't know if you're talking about government-funded things, but I think there are a lot more important things to do with life. If people want to pray, you know, be my guest, and I hope they pray for me because I have a terrible virus right now. But I don't think it should be spent on money. The other thing is just on the question of God's paying attention to people's problems. I noticed that before a lot of prize fights, they both cross themselves. Now, what is God, a tout? I mean, what is he doing there? You know, he's going to say, well, I like this guy because he's black. I like this guy because he's Latin. I like this guy because he's got 2 pounds, you know. What is God then? What is God? I mean, we can all pray, and 50% of the people will get their answer.
Could I respond to that,
Steve? Go
Dick?
Ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the bottom line here is that if people believe God must respond to their prayers, then it's very likely that when God does not respond to their prayers, they will lose faith. I think that was the gist of the call from down south a bit ago. The bottom line is that philosophically, people do suffer. We are frail. We are mortal creatures. When we pray in these contexts of severe diagnoses and other significant human limit situations, I think that we need to be very careful because we need to be open to the reality that difficult moments occur. There's nothing unusual about that. They don't need explanation. I disagree with the whole idea of trying to explain why bad things happen to good people. Bad things happen to everybody. If we get into a mentality where we're petitioning God so as to remove a kind of utilitarian happiness from the unhappiness from right. the face of the earth and from our lives, I think then we're kidding ourselves about the fundamental nature of human experience and reality.
Some of it is just a casualness, I think, Larry Doncey, mm-hmm. about religion, where, you know, a prize fighter might cross himself not to say, God must help me here, but God might help and, you know, can't hurt.
Can't hurt, that's right. I want to disagree with Stephen a bit here. I think that many of these studies go beyond the impact of one's belief on whether or not the prayer is going to work or not. These studies are what we call double blind. Many of the people don't even know they're being prayed for. And even if they did, this is another compelling reason to take these studies out of the non-human domain into the area of laboratory animals and plants and so on, where belief does not enter. I disagree that it's so strange that people would pray for animals or plants. I happen to have grown up on a farm in Central Texas, and we were praying at all times for animals and plants and
rain.
Seeds to grow and rain and for the rain to come, the rain to stop, and so on. So for many people around the world, it's not strange at all that we would pray in these non-human dimensions. So I am extremely reluctant to criticize this as belonging to the domain of ESP or mm-hmm. parapsychology. Most farmers would just plain call it prayer.
1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, what do you call it, and can it be measured? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Here and Now at noon, we'll have the latest news, plus the UN Security Council's wrangling over whether to approve the use of force against Iraq, and a report.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. With us on the program this hour, Stephen Post, biomedical ethicist at the School of Medicine at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. Larry Doncey's with us. He's a physician of internal medicine and author of the bestseller Healing Words, The Power of Prayer and the Practice of Medicine. We're talking about the power of prayer. And Larry, if I can, I want to just take where you left off prior to the break with the next step. If we're talking about the ability to measure the effect of prayer, does that mean that at some point some scientist will posit that you need 50 people to pray to expect a result, and so that if there were 100 people praying, that would be twice as good or twice as powerful? You see where I'm going with this. I just don't know how far you think it can go.
Well, that question has often been raised. If a little bit of prayer is good, is a whole lot better. There have been some feeble attempts to try to quantitate the effects of prayer, but so far no one has shown that a prayer from 100 people is 10 times more effective than prayer from 10 people. I think there's no doubt that issues such as sincerity and quality and the level of compassion and love that one brings to the task of prayer are critical factors in how well it works. My reading of these studies so far is that if I had to pick one factor which outweighs all others, it certainly isn't which religion people belong to or probably even how many people are praying for you, but mm-hmm. the level of love and compassion that whoever is praying for you brings to that task. So I think we're a long way from saying that we want 50 instead of 10 people to pray for somebody.
Stephen Post, can I hear from you on this?
I agree entirely with Larry on that last point. I think that so much of what we mean by spirituality has to do with compassion, has to do with love. And if there is a God above, my intuition would be that he or she or it would respond to a prayer that was deeply informed by affective affirmation, love, forgiveness, companionship, and so forth. I think that's an important point. People are praying for what, with what motivations?
I want to be clear that I understand the difference here. I'm imagining, say you say to me, all right, Dick, I'd like you to pray for this young girl in Iraq. And I have a choice. I can pray to God that God will help that person, and that's the prayer that we've been discussing, sort of intercessory prayer. But what you're talking about in terms of this love is that I'm just praying or thinking directly of that girl. I'm not going up. I'm just going straight across. Is that the difference that we're talking about here?
Well, in my view, if I might, when a stranger prays for person X, there is no personal relationship involved. There may be some generic loving intentionality. That's different than when a mother prays for an ill daughter, where you have all of the compassion associated with the right. Parent-child axis. And it would seem to me that that would be a considerable difference in terms of the quality and tonality of prayer.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Santa Rosa, California. Pam's on the line. Hi, Pam.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
No, you bet. I just am so excited about this program because I don't know. I feel like we need to pull out all the stops right now, and if prayer's an option, let's pray. I mean, our needs are so great.
You put an if in front of there. If prayer's an option.
I mean, if we're throwing that into the table,
right?
Saying we're in some pretty crisis situations now, and I know, and I have to say, I know prayer's an option. I'm a career healer. I'm a Christian Science healer. I've been doing it for 18 years.
Are you talking about praying for people you don't know as well as for people that you do know, Pam?
I pray for people who drop me an email on the internet or get a phone call. Probably half of my practice are people I never meet. So you bet.
And are you saying that in your view, that kind of long distance, I don't know you, but I'll pray for you, prayer can be or is as effective as something that's more specific and more direct and someone you know?
Yeah, because it's very much up to me. It's not up to that other individual. I agree with the gentleman when they said that it's the level of compassion and love you bring to it. And I work with Science and Health. I've worked with Mrs. Eddy's book for years. And her sense is, and what's helped me so much, that there are universal laws of God that are in operation.
Tell me something, Pam. You said this was your business. Do people pay you to pray for them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, yes, yes.
Does that diminish the value of the prayer at all if you're taking money for it?
Well, I have to eat. And this is the thing that I love to do because I get to help people. I get to help lives, and yet I still have to put bread on the table. So
but if you pray for someone and nothing happens, you still get paid, right?
You know something? If I pray for someone and nothing happens, many times I don't bill, and many times they will want to pay anyway.
Right, right.
Because something happens. That's my point of saying let's not throw prayer out. Something happens every time. There is improvement every time.
Okay, Pam. Thanks for your call. Stephen Post, just the idea that Pam's presenting, that there are other ways of quantifying prayer that, you know, in her case, involve making a living doing it.
Oh, I don't mind if a Christian Science practitioner puts a little bread on the table. That doesn't necessarily raise doubts about motivational purity.
Does it bring us any closer to an understanding of the effectiveness or the power of prayer, though?
Well, it complicates things considerably. Our prayers, however they're praying in these various studies, being compensated for their work. What is the degree of self-interest that might, in fact, taint the tone and quality of their inner motivations? Those are things that are impossible to get at scientifically. They're so deeply subjective, that may be a confounding element in these kinds of studies.
Let's move along to Madison, Wisconsin. James is joining us now. Hi, James.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. I'm calling because I'm wondering if there have been studies conducted in other fields other than in the field of medicine.
You mean the effect of prayer outside medicine?
Yes, the effect of prayer outside of medicine.
Larry, do you know about that?
Well, there are scores of studies, as we've already touched on, looking at the effects of prayer and people's intentions and willing and wishing.
But that don't have to do with health. That's what we're...
That's correct. Unless you want to say, refer to health in animals. You know, some people would say that the rate of tumor growth in animals is really a health issue. Certainly is for veterinarians.
Fair enough.
There have been studies that really do creep up on this idea of prayer in non-humans. Yeah.
Why are you asking, James?
I'm an educational researcher at UW-Madison, doing my PhD work here, and I'm doing a study on prayer for teachers, like empowering them, gaining greater strength. And I believe there was a medical study conducted by O'Leary in which the prayers, there was a significant difference in the prayers themselves. So they gain strength in terms of lower rates of depression, reduced anxiety, that sort of thing. And I'm wondering if there are other studies outside of medicine that are conducted in this area.
Just before we go to that, James, I want to make sure that I understand what you're looking at here. This is, as we've been discussing earlier on the program, people praying for teachers who aren't necessarily in that classroom, in that school, but praying at a distance?
No, I'm looking at the teachers themselves who may perhaps pray.
Right.
And wondering if they find strength from their prayer, if it affects them personally. So not necessarily an analogous study to the medical studies would be people praying on behalf of the teachers or praying on behalf of the students. But I'm looking at specifically what are the results on the teachers who pray.
Well, you know, there was this one study which you mentioned that actually looked at the effect of prayer on the people doing the praying. That's the only one that has been done. There is a lore that prayer is good not only for the individual to whom it is directed, but for the person who's doing it too. That study you mentioned suggests that there's something to that.
Are we talking here about the difference between healing and coping, I wonder? Stephen?
Well, that's a very good question. By the way, Eric Erickson was famous for stating that generativity, generous, other-regarding, kind, creative behavior, was as good for the giver as it is for the recipient, and he did look at psychological factors such as well-being and self-esteem. So, in my opinion, in response to James, it would not be surprising at all if people who prayed in significant ways for students were more attentive to tasks, were more devoted in some respects, possibly, I'm not sure, to their purposes in life.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. And Larry Dossey, I guess in a way that brings us back to just talking about the type of people who would be praying, because the way that Stevens, you know, talks about the different character, that's again something which in a way seems to me would complicate trying to measure it scientifically, wouldn't it? If we're talking about someone who is predisposed to prayer or thinking of themselves in a larger universe rather than, you know, being selfish and bullying ahead and living a life of stress.
Well, I'm not sure I understand your query, Dick.
I guess what I'm saying is when we're talking about measuring the therapeutic value of prayer, whether or not it's for the person who is prayed for or the person who is doing the praying, it you need to in some way take into account, measure, the character of the person who is either receiving or giving the prayer as well.
Oh, I think so. You know, I think one thing that gets missed here is common sense sometimes. This is not so mysterious, I think, in one way as it might seem. For example, we select our physicians who use drugs and surgical procedures on us using internal criteria such as warmth and bedside manner. And we would all rather affiliate with doctors who have those qualities. So it seems to me that that applies also to who would want to pray for us. Warmth and bedside manner are just analogous to compassion and love in the prayer dimension. So I think it's not so strange that love and compassion and deep heartfelt caring on the part of people who are praying would be important.
Larry, just briefly, there are a number of studies that are currently underway, and the scientists who are doing those can't talk about them because that will foul up the results. But are we going to hear and see more in the months and years ahead on this?
There are studies, you're quite right, that are under wraps now that are going on at some of the major medical institutions in the country. Doctors are seemingly getting their courage up to go ahead and do these studies, so I can't see that this is going to go away anytime soon.
And Stephen Post, just whether or not you think that the conversation about understanding or measuring the power of prayer can change if there are more studies put on the table.
Oh, I think it can change, but even without the studies, we are seeing the emergence of a new respect for the spirituality of patients coping with, for example, an imminent surgical event. Many surgeons will, in fact, if requested by a patient, pray prior to surgery with that patient. So there's a tremendous sense of the importance, especially in American culture, where religion is so central, the importance of being attentive to patient spirituality, making appropriate referrals to clinical pastoral care, and in general, utilizing the spiritual beliefs and practices of patients in order to reach more beneficial outcomes.
Something as simple as bedside manner as well, as Larry's saying.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
All right, Stephen, thanks for being with us.
Pleasure. Thank you, Dick.
Stephen Post, a medical ethicist at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. Larry Dossey, thank you for your time.
Pleasure, Dick. Thanks.
Larry's a physician of internal medicine and author of several books, including Healing Words, The Power of Prayer, and The Practice of Medicine. Thanks also to Jeff Carlton, engineer at WCPN, the NPR station in Cleveland, for your help. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Major funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com. Cassettes and CDs of The Connection are available from WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced. Visit us online at www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Newman School, a small co-ed college preparation.